Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Happy Tuesday. Today is Cinco de Mayo, 2015. I'm Michelle Fiché, filling in for Jeannie, and I'm here today with Dr. Timothy Hayes. We warmly welcome you to the show, and thank you for choosing to be with us. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk with our host. We encourage you to call in with your comments or questions, allowing you to actively strengthen and deepen your practice. Now, let's welcome Tim in support of developing our inner process of Aramaic forgiveness.
Thank you, Michelle. How are you today?
I'm doing real great today. Tuesday's my work from home day, and so I'm just cranking out, feeling very productive.
Well, thank you for running the switchboard and keeping tabs on the chat room. And welcome, everyone, to the show. We are honored to have this time to share with you, and we're grateful, deep appreciation for everyone who chooses to be with us on these calls. The point of our being here is to teach and support people in learning and developing greater and greater facility with the ancient Aramaic tool of forgiveness. And one of the biggest hurdles we have in teaching the ancient Aramaic technology of forgiveness is clarifying the difference between that and what most of us have been taught, at least in Western cultures, that forgiveness means that I acknowledge somebody did something wrong. It's a government standard, it's a social standard, it's a family standard, and everyone agrees, yes, what this person did was wrong, and then, because I'm a bigger person or I'm stronger or I have more resources, I'll go ahead and acknowledge that even though they should be punished for this, I'll let them off the hook. And that's what most of us have been taught in terms of forgiveness, at least in Western cultures. And the ancient Aramaic process of forgiveness is pretty much the opposite. It's an understanding that who I am, my true nature, can't be hurt by anything anybody else ever says or does, has never caused my upset or my internal sadness, my internal fear, my internal pain, regret, guilt, or shame. And there's nothing to let them off the hook for. And forgiveness in the ancient Aramaic was built on the understanding that since I'm creating all of those internal feelings of anger, fear, sadness, shame, guilt, fear, confusion, resentment, that I have the ability to choose differently within me and create something else. And what it is that I create is a shift in the focus of my conscious awareness. So I shift my conscious awareness over to my true nature, and I create a present moment awareness that I'm safe, that I'm loved, loving, and lovable forever, as is everyone and everything around me. And I create an awareness that everything that's happening around me can be viewed as the expression of love or as a call for help and healing. And in that process, of how I choose to interpret and respond to the events around me, I create my experience of life. And the ancient Aramaic process of forgiveness has been made available through Dr. Rice and his website, and Jeannie, who has many, many hours of creatively arranging the website and thousands of items and pages of material around this theme and around the core tool of forgiveness, which is called the Reality Management Worksheet, or the Reality and Stress Management Worksheet. Some versions have been called Change Your Mind, Change Your Life. But they all have at their core the same tool, which is the realization that if I become aware of an energy less than love, and I have the awareness that that's a false creation of mine, and it may have come down from my generations, or it might be just from a twist in my perception in the moment. But if I become aware of it and I understand how the system works, I can literally in the moment remove that energy, remove that thought, remove that discomfort from my system. And when I do, it's like taking a bushel basket off of a light and the light shines. When I do, it's like removing any roadblock to my seeing my true nature as the energy of love, as the energy of creation that's trying to express through me, as the energy of love and creation that's here to extend to everyone and everything I see and to bless all of creation in every moment. And if I do that, I have a very different experience of life than what my culture teaches me. And various cultures teach different things, but most in the Western culture today are taught, turn on the television, buy into the shows, put your mind at our disposal, and we will fill it full of very finely crafted commercials which are designed to subliminally convince you that you need this or that in order to be whole or happy or safe or free. And you will become a good consumer and you will become a good contributing member of society. That's an option. And it's made very, 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 very easy in this culture. We're offering something else. We're offering a suggestion that your true nature is the energy of love and creation, and that your purpose on this planet, in general, everyone's purpose is the same, and that is to build their awareness of their spiritual body, to strengthen it, and to extend that in every interaction. And specifically, each of us is given a set of individual tools, preferences, skills, passions. And if we tune into those, we can craft a secondary purpose. And if we pour the energy into doing that secondary purpose and that primary purpose, we will have a very different experience of life. So that's what we're here to support. And we're here to take your comments and your questions, not just about that primary tool, which is the tool of forgiveness and the seven-step worksheet process that's available on www.whyagain.org, but also the host of other tools that are available on that website, which include the one I was just referring to, which is called it's not the Mind Goal Management. It's the primary and secondary purpose tool. It's the idea of having having a goal, having a focus for my life that's created internally, that comes from tuning into what I was given by the Creator with this unique blend of what we call physical chemistry from my mother and father, and this unique blend of life experiences and teachers I've had, and this unique perspective that I bring to the planet about what really excites me, what creates a passion in my life. And when I focus my energies based on those things, I bring into focus and I increase the power and effectiveness of my life energy and the creative force that I'm here to express. And I accomplish more, and I have more satisfaction, and I touch more lives in a loving way than I ever could if my energy were scattered all over or spent focused on the YouTube videos or the television reality shows or the news of all the trauma and drama. And so if you have a question about any of the tools, the Mind Goal Management Sheet, which teaches me how to manage the stress in my life and find a way to create the stresses that are good and healthy and help me achieve my primary and secondary purpose, and help me eliminate the process I've engaged in most of my young life because of the conditioning of my culture that has me creating a lot of unnecessary, unproductive, unhealthy, unpleasant stress. So if you have any questions about anything we've talked about so far, anything you've heard in the past few weeks on the show, anything you've experienced by being at an intensive, we would love to hear your comments and questions, because that's how the shows get deeper and richer. And I'll take a breath and ask Michelle if we have anybody with a hand up or anybody in the chat room with a comment.
No, we've got several callers listening and several guests, but right now things are quiet.
All right. Well, then I'll talk a little bit about something that's been coming up for me lately, and that is something I mentioned just briefly yesterday. The idea that a lot of different spiritual teachings have the idea in them that we must die to be reborn. And a lot of them have the concept that there's a lower self, a physical, a sensing, craving hunger for food and sexual gratification and accumulation of goods. And then there's a higher self. And the higher self has the ability to appreciate a sunset, the ability to tune into the emotions that another might be feeling and be aware of how one person's comments or interactions or behaviors affect those around him or her. A higher self that can tune into the existence of energies beyond just the very gross physical motor energies that hit the five senses. And the idea of dying to the lower self so that the higher self can be reborn weaves itself through many different spiritual traditions. And literal interpretations of these spiritual traditions or key lessons or tools destroys the power of the tool. And so for thousands of years, there's been an ongoing battle between people who want to interpret, let's say, a parable literally, or a true spiritual teaching literally, and those who want to look at the deeper, more subtle, more expansive meaning behind a spiritual truth, behind a parable, behind a pattern of interaction which can reveal a whole world of experience beyond the gross physical senses, the five senses of sight, taste, touch, smell, hearing. And if you look at what's available in just the five senses, and you think that life is nothing more than the game of who can accumulate the most, then you get one experience of life. And yet, for thousands upon thousands of years, and we're still just learning how many thousands of years, you know, it seems like every month I see another news story on different channels about an older civilization that was found that had more advances beyond anything they could have imagined. And for thousands of years, there has been an awareness that if I slow the input of my physical senses and I slow the momentum of my mind, which wants to chatter and rationalize and figure out, I can move into an experience that is every bit as powerful, if not more powerful, than that provided by tuning into the physical senses. And that opens up a flexibility, a tolerance, a loving within me for myself and others that simply isn't available through simple linear logic and using the input of the five senses. So one of the examples I've used on different times is we've talked about this several times. There's a website that the CIA has a page where it put up a chapter of a book, and the chapter of the book is titled, "Why is it we cannot see what is there right in front of us to be seen?" And the reason we can't see what's there in front of us to be seen is that we have a very active process of perception. Each of us, when we stand in front of a field, and there might be wildflowers and budding grass, maybe some ferns just uncurling with their brilliant green color, maybe some bees flying over the tops of the little spring flowers, maybe a pony prancing in the distance, blue sky with some puffy white clouds dotting the horizon. Every one of us who stands at that field, at that meadow, and opens his or her eyes, sees something different. And there's a very active process of perception that we use to filter out the hundreds of trillions of bits of information that come at us, and we filter out what we deem as irrelevant, and we focus in on what we deem as most important. Let's say that we're standing, there's a group of us, and we're maybe there's 10 people listening to the radio show now, and we're all together at an intensive, and we're standing looking at that field. And one of us just absolutely loves horses. They love the majesty. They love the nobility that they sense when the horse prances. And another one of us is a botanist and loves gardening and knows the name of every plant and knows when the next batch of spring flowers is coming up and what their names are and what colors are going to be and which ones of their roots are good to make tea to calm a headache. And another one of us, looking out at that field or standing there, the 10 of us together, one of us knows that they're highly allergic to bee stings. Now, if you just take those three out of the 10 of us who are looking at this field, and you imagine the reality that's created in each of those three minds, I hope you can sense how dramatically different the experience is going to be for each of those three people, or each of those 10 by extension. And yet they're standing there right by side, shoulder to shoulder, viewing the same field, viewing the same meadow, viewing the same flowers and insects and horses and rabbits and sky and clouds. And yet each of us creates in each moment a very specific, highly individualized, highly different experience of life when we're faced with the same 220 trillion bits of information. How does that happen? Why does that happen? What is it that's useful to us in a spiritual sense? What is it that's useful to us in a psychological sense? What is it that's useful to us in a relationship sense from knowing that that happens? that that's the actual process of perception. It's not a passive process. 10 people standing shoulder to shoulder viewing the same meadow, all 10 open their eyes, they do not see the same thing. They do not experience the same thing. They do not have the same images, physical sensations, and emotions resonated in their brain cells. Let's say that one of the other 10 people in that stand of 10 of us looking at the field is a beekeeper and absolutely loves bees, studies bees, and is filled with the sense of joy, can almost taste the honey that this particular field is going to generate from bees. Maybe it's a clover field, there's a lot of clover in it. Maybe there's buckwheat in the field, it's going to be that dark, rich buckwheat honey. And so here's somebody standing right next to someone who's terrified and in a crisis and doing nothing but watching the bees and feeling terror, and another person right next to them watching the bees and feeling the delight and having the fond memories of maybe how her grandmother taught her beekeeping and taught her how to tend the hives and make sure the bees had plenty of honey and how they were healthy and the best uses for the different types of honey. And they're right there next to each other looking at the very same external stimulation and having a dramatically different internal experience. And this is a process that happens for every one of us all day, every day of our lives. And what creates my experience in the moment is what gets resonated from my brain cells of past experiences and the brain cells I have from my bloodline. And the idea that there are cross-generational patterns that are so strong and so powerful and yet completely invisible to us is woven into this idea of perception in a way that most people have no idea that they actively perceive, and that they're screening out most of the stimuli in their environment and choosing to focus only in a tiny, tiny fraction of a way on one thing or another. And so then they have no way of blending that with the knowledge that cross-generational patterns are so strong that they can run our lives completely invisibly to us. So how does that relate to a relationship? Well, we've given a number of different examples, but I'd like to give one today that came to mind. I did an advanced family therapy training years ago where I think there were 13 of us who went to this 9-month or 10-month seminar, and we met once a month for 4 or 5 months, and then we had a 2-month break, and then we met again. And the 2-month break was over the summer, so people could go on their vacations and see family. And what happened in this process was each one of us took turns being the subject, while the rest of us sat around and just observed. And the woman who ran the class interviewed us and did a genogram. And the genogram was a picture she drew based on the information that the subject gave her. And she would ask, now, are you single or married? And if you're single or married, then if you're a man, you get a square. If you're a woman, you get a circle. And then, did you have any siblings? And your siblings are attached to you with lines to show that you're related. And then your parents, and that they have siblings, and that they have children from the siblings. And then, so as the picture gets built, it's from the bottom up this page, a big, long, white page, like a poster board page. And the woman is only writing down the information that the subject is giving her in answer to her questions. And when she gets to the top of the page, which is as far up as the person can remember, whether it's great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents, she has a network of connected circles and squares, and there's a name above each square, and there's either a number in the square or circle, or a number in the square or circle with a line drawn through it representing someone who's deceased. And now here's my family tree. And then as she comes down, she asks questions of the subject about what they know about the relationships between the people in their family. How did your grandmother and your great-grandmother and your great-grandmother and grandmother relate to each other? How did your great-grandmother and great-grandfather get along? How did they get along with their children? How did their children relate to each other? And so with squiggly lines and dotted lines and colored lines, a picture is drawn on the way down about the interconnected relationships in the family. And so by the time she's down at the bottom and she's asked questions and listened to the answers and drawn out the responses on this chart, she has completed a very vivid picture of a person's family interaction patterns that goes back for as many generations as a person can remember. And every one of us that sat in the chair being the subject was absolutely blind to patterns of interaction that were seen by everybody else in the room, even though it was the person who was living it, who was answering the questions, who had all the information, who was blind to it. Now, the most powerful example from this was there was a woman in our group, and because we were all therapists with at least 10 years of experience doing therapy, master's level and doctor's level therapists, so it was an advanced class, and there was a woman who had a 12-year-old daughter, and she began talking to us from our first few sessions of getting to know each other about how all these problems she was having with her daughter. And, of course, if you're with a group of therapists and somebody's got a problem, everybody's got an answer. Everybody's got several answers. And what we noticed from the very beginning with this woman was that every time somebody mentioned, why don't you try this with your daughter, why don't you try that, it's either something that either can't be done or something that's already tried and failed. And after several months of meeting and talking, getting to know each other, everybody was convinced by this woman that she really didn't have any choice but to protect the sanity and safety of her family, she was going to have to send her 12-year-old daughter to a residential treatment center because she was so out of control, because she was so disruptive, because she was so violent, etc. And I was one of the last people to give in because I came from a loving family and I thought, you know, family's important. But eventually even I sided with her in saying, yeah, I guess I really, really tried everything. It sounds like everything I can think of and everything all these other marvelous therapists can think of. So you might as well face the facts. You're probably going to have to ship her away. Well, then came the month where she was in the subject's seat. So she sat down, and the leader of the group asked her questions and drew the picture all the way up, four generations back. And when she came down, she asked about all of the different relationships and where these kids were and what their relationship was like to their parents. And there was an audible gasp several different times in this session from probably most of us who were watching. And when it was over, when they got to the bottom, I was one of several people who said to her, let's say her name is Betty, Betty, you can't send your daughter away. And she was indignant and said, what do you mean I can't? Everybody agreed with me. She's a mess. It's hurting the whole family. The picture that had been drawn from her own information that she was completely blind to was that if she sent her daughter away out of the family, it would be the fifth generation in which the second oldest female had been sent away from the family at 10 or 11 or 12 years of age. And she was completely blind to the pattern. And every one of us who sat in that seat had similar, maybe not as dramatic, but similar patterns that everybody else in the room could see that we couldn't see. So we said to her, you can't send your daughter away. And she said, why, that's crazy. You were agreeing with me. You were one of the strongest proponents for this. And we would say, look, it's going to be five generations. And she would say, well, that's irrelevant because when my mother was younger, they lived on a farm in the South. And the oldest daughter was okay because she could help with the babies. But a second daughter was just an extra mouth to feed, and she couldn't work in the fields. So it only makes sense that by the time she gets old enough to start doing housework, they would lend her out to a family that needed her and could afford to, feed her. Because otherwise it's just an empty mouth, an extra mouth to feed, and she can't be productive. She had every rationalization in the book to move ahead and continue a cross-generational pattern that was already four generations deep, maybe more. Even with us trying to coach her to see the pattern, she was willing and able to rationalize it. And I'm here to tell you that every one of us that sat in that chair had a similar experience. And if 13 different highly experienced master's and doctorate level therapists were that blind to their cross-generational issues, I would offer it's worth considering that we're all blind to our cross-generational issues, and that the tools we're offering at whyagain.org, the tools including the reality management worksheet, the three earliest memories of conflict, the codependent to interdependent relationship, they are well worth every bit of effort it takes to pick them up and apply them to my life and get some clarity about how I'm simply repeating old unproductive patterns from the past every time I'm feeling angry, sad, scared, hurt, or frustrated, and that the alarm system that Creator gave me was not intended to tell me when something's wrong in somebody else's life. It's intended to tell me when something's wrong in my life. And if I focus internally, and if I have the awareness that it's all an inside job, and if I have the tools like those provided on this website, I have the infinite capacity to create a different, more loving experience of life. And that's what we'd like to help people do. And I'll take a breath, Michelle, and see if you have any comments or if there's any questions or anybody with a hand up.
So quiet. I think everyone's just enjoying that story. I know it was meaningful to me being a therapist, and I guess I have lots of friends who are therapists, and sometimes those counselors and masters in social works and such. I think sometimes I see that I have the greatest blind spots of all. And I'm in therapy 25 hours a week. My clients are just there 1 hour a week. So I see myself in some of your words today.
Well, it's one of the more powerful experiences I've had. Of course, it's you talked about an experience, I think it was just last week, where you created a perception that was completely false, and you went up to a person and said to him, I'm so glad your wife was able to be here to see this or whatever, and he said, she wasn't here. And in that moment, you got some insight into your own unconscious. You got some insight into your active, false creating of a perception that never happened. And those moments in our lives are rare. But I'll offer another one because it came to mind last week when you brought up this example. And I try and tell people from real life examples, just watch. Don't believe what I'm saying. But watch in your own life for examples where two or more people are looking at the same event and taking away a completely different experience and interpretation. Look for examples in your own life where your unconscious was blinding you to something, and later you get to see it. And if it happened once, open yourself to the possibility that it happens on a regular basis, and you only get to see it in those rare moments.
Yeah.
And here's an example. A time when I got to see my unconscious at work. And it was one of the more powerful examples in my life where it was just so, it was all laid out for me. And I was I was father of two young boys and a psychologist, and I had a young family come to see me. And they brought their child in, and it was a first session, and I didn't know why they were coming yet. But so they came into my relatively small office, and they had the baby in one of those car seat carriers where you just flip the handle up and then, you know, you carry the baby, and because it's an infant.
A baby bucket.
This is, pardon me?
I call those baby buckets.
So it's a baby bucket, and this is an infant who had been born within the past few weeks. I mean, it's a very, very young infant. And it's just the mother and father and the baby in the bucket. And they walk in, and the mother set the baby down in the bucket in a chair and took three steps across the room and sat down on the love seat away from the baby in the bucket. And the father sat down next to her two full steps away from the baby in the bucket. And I thought, wow, this is odd. Because normally, even if the infant is asleep, when I've seen parents interacting with infants that young, they hold the baby, they put the baby on the floor between their feet, or they take the baby out and cuddle it the whole time. So even though it's not that big an office, it struck me that there was this distance between the baby and the parents. And we had our session, and guess what the problem was? The problem was, this couple had a four-year-old daughter who not even 1 week earlier, I mean a four-year-old daughter who not even 1 week earlier had died on the operating table for what was supposed to be a routine adenoid or tonsil procedure. So it was very, very intense. They were feeling a lot of sadness. They were, you know, my clinical mind was making interpretations like, well, this mother is afraid to get close to this new infant because, you know, she's still in shock from the loss of her four-year-old. And so we had our session. And somewhere in the next 2 weeks, I went home and my young wife said to me, that, you know, we had this, maybe four-year-old son, maybe five-year-old son, but very close in age to the little girl that died. And my wife said to me, I've just made all the arrangements for our son to have tubes put in his ears. And I was, I'm the great and powerful Dr. Hayes. You know, I'm going to do it right. I thought I better not say anything to her about this family. I don't want to dump on my wife and my son all the fears about this horrible experience that this other family had. After all, lots and lots of people have successful surgeries for tubes in their ears and tonsils and adenoids, et cetera, and they live happily. And so I said in my mind, I better not say anything to her about that. And so what I did manage to say was, have you thought about getting a second opinion? And, of course, she'd thought all about that, and her mother was a nurse, and we got the approval through these doctors, and she met the doctors, and she loves them, and it's all set up. So fast forward to the day of the surgery. My wife is working, and I take my two sons the one who's 3 or 4 and the other one who's only 16 months older. I drive the 45 minutes down to the hospital. They put him under. He wakes up. It's a horrible thing to have a 3 or 4 year old come out of a general anesthetic, completely disoriented, flailing around, scared to death, can't even tell who I am as the parent, go through that whole thing. He's throwing up all the way home in the car, and I'm trying to drive and catch the vomit and all the wonderful things that happen as a young parent. I get in the house. I get him set up, get his brother set up with some toys, get him set up with something cool, like a popsicle or whatever for his throat. And I call my sister to let her know that her young nephew came through the surgery just fine. And on the end of the phone, I say to my sister, "Just wanted you to know that your nephew came through the surgery just fine." And my sister snaps at me, "What surgery?" And I said, "Oh, you know, he had tubes put in his ears and it just went." "How come you didn't tell me?" "Well, I don't know. I just want to let you know that it's fine." "And, well, I can't believe you didn't tell me." And she's just furious. And I was just dumbfounded and just confused and just, you know, mildly amused by all of her upset. And I said, "Well, just wanted you to know. Got some other calls to make. I'll keep you posted." And I hung up. You know, gee, that's really odd. So the next week, I'm in my office, and I've thought occasionally about, it wasn't that weird how angry my sister got about my son's surgery. And I'm in my office, and I go out to get my next patient, and it's this young couple. And as they stand up and walk across the waiting room with the baby in the bucket, I get a full-blown mental image of exactly what happened. And it was difficult for me to pay attention to them during that session because I was faced with the full-blown panoramic view of what my mind did when my wife told me she had set up a surgery for our son. And I said in my mind, "I'd better not say anything about this patient I know and their trauma." And my mind literally told no one about my son's surgery. I didn't tell my mother. I didn't tell my brother. I didn't tell my coworkers. I didn't tell my sister. I didn't tell my other sister. I didn't tell any friends. The people that found out about my son's surgery prior to it happening were people who heard from my wife. And she just assumed that I would tell my side of the family and she would tell her side. And my unconscious mind said, "You better not say anything." And it just slammed shut like a steel trap door and then bolted and locked it. And I blocked out all of the knowledge of my son's surgery, of the four-year-old that I know that died from a similar, quote, routine, unquote, surgery, all of the horrors going on inside me as a worried father. I blocked it all out when in the moment I made the decision not to dump that anger, that fear, that confusion, that terror about the dangers of a surgery on a child that young on my wife. And the simple phrase rang out in my head. I saw myself standing there saying, "I better not say anything." And that was enough. The rest of the thought was to my wife about this other surgery that went horribly wrong. And I got to see, that's what my unconscious mind does to me all the time. I rarely get to see it that clearly, but I later called my sister and apologized. I called my brother and apologized because we're a relatively close family. We don't usually have major medical procedures for ourselves or our children without, you know, putting it out there for love and prayers and thoughts and letting everybody know. And here, the most significant medical procedure in my young family, other than the birth of my children, was happening, and I completely shut down. And later on, I got to see why. I got to see how. And I would offer this as a story for how we all do this all day long. And all of the tools on whyagain.org as a worksheet, as a process, whether it's the Mind Shifter tool or Three Earliest Memories of Conflict or the Mind Goal Management Sheet or the Reality Management Worksheet or the Codependence or Interdependence Worksheet, they're all designed to help me uncover unconscious conclusions, beliefs, fears, processes, traumas, just like that one, that run my life unless or until I become aware of them. So again, I'll take a breath, and I'll ask if there are any comments from you, Michelle, or anybody else with a question or a comment.
No, not right now. We've got all guests in the chat room, and so they can't put any words down. They can't type. And no hands up. You did a really good job explaining that situation that happened to me, and I understand how your family situation and the fears that were unconsciously generating your behaviors and your thoughts going forward. I often think about it, and you're right, the little glimpses are helpful to illustrate that it is going on all the time, and it's rather alarming how any of us even manage to get along, given that we're all just spinning in our own world sometimes. Because I am aware of it, I've slowed down a lot in terms of my reactiveness to upset. And just this weekend, we were expecting my stepdaughter home at 3 o'clock, and it's 3:10, and I'm ready to shoot off some demanding emails, texts, and something said, you know what, you need to check first. And I went upstairs and I said to my husband, Emma's not home yet. And he goes, yes, she is. She came and saw me. And I was sitting in my office, which faces the front door, and somehow I missed the car coming to drive and the front door opening because I think I believed so sincerely that she would be late. And, sure enough, she was up in a room. And it's almost like I think I blanked out the whole, process of a car coming up our long driveway, the front door opening and closing, the noise on the steps, the whole shebang. And again, thank goodness I went to confirm what I was assuming and was, informed that I was wrong, way, way wrong.
Well, the glory of the system that we've been given is that it's got a flawless mechanism built in. The problem is most of us have been trained to think that when the alarm goes off, it means something outside of us needs to change and somebody outside of us is wrong. But there's that flawless alarm system built in that any time I'm angry, sad, scared, hurt, or frustrated, what it means is I am in error. If I'm in pain, I'm in error. And that flawless alarm system is there to guide me to truth and happiness and break off the effects of my errors in thought if I just tune into it and ask it to. When I'm angry, it's the problem in me. When I'm sad, it's the problem in me. If I'm worried, there's a problem in me. And the difficulty with our culture is that it teaches us a backwards application of this flawless system. And of course, if we try and do something, exactly the opposite of the way it was designed to be done, it's not likely to go so well.
No. And I'm so grateful for the tools because it has really prevented a lot of difficulties in my personal life in terms of just like the example I gave where, I thought to use the tool and knew that the dynamics of my perception were probably off. And then, I was so happy that I at least was remembering to use it. You know, you were speaking about all the different worksheets and tools on the website. My private practice is right by Michigan State, and so I have lots of college-age students, and oftentimes one of the primary diagnoses they're coming in with is anxiety related to school and their future and their choices, and they have to decide what they want to do for the rest of their life when they're 22 years old. And invariably, I present to them the tool for the purpose.
Personal power and commitment.
Yes. I pulled it up because I was looking at it in terms of the primary, developing a spiritual conscious body, and then the secondary. And then I can explain that worksheet tool to young students in less than 15 minutes. And I recently got feedback from a young man who had gone to the school, like guidance counseling office, where they administer tests and ask them, you know, a bazillion questions to evaluate, and then it spits out, well, you know, you can be suitable to be a funeral director, a nurse anesthetist, or, you know, heating and cooling guy. And he said, you know, the tool that I had presented, Dr. Michael Rice's work with the purpose and commitment worksheet, is, he said, was more valuable than, you know, three-hour sessions at the school guidance counselor, which I thought that was a nice testimony because it really just zeroes in like a laser focus on people's passion. So not a job, not a, you know, career, it's a vocation, and how to be a contribution to the world in each unique individual way. So I just wanted to share that because I feel so helpful to people when I present it because they just get so much value from it.
Yeah, it's really, it's a wonderful thing to think about life as a symphony and each one of us as unique instruments that can only, we are the only ones that can play our particular notes in that symphony. And it's meant to be wonderful. It's meant to be some of the most beautiful music ever heard. Our lives are meant to be a part of that. And if it's not, if we're not feeling that way, then there's work to be done. And the good news is, when there's work to be done, there are the tools and the willingness that everything gets better. Some people, you know, like Maynard G. Krebs from the old Dobie Gillis, you say the word work and they break out in hives. But when there's work to be done and there are tools and the willingness, it literally means things are about to get a lot better. That's part of my appreciation and gratitude to Michael and Jeannie for putting these tools out there and supporting me in learning how to use them and apply them to my life.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a nice way to put it, the symphony and the uniqueness of the individuals. I like to think the concept of that masters are those where there's no distinction between work and play. And so that if you're really finding something you're passionate about and enjoy doing and comes naturally, then, you know, you wouldn't retire. You would not even think about it as a concept because you're playing all day, and what's to retire from?
Yeah, that's why the great master Joseph Campbell was often heard to say to his students, when they would ask him, what should we do? He would say, simply follow your bliss. And it just ties in with the age-old adage that if you find something you love to do, you'll never work another day in your life. Because as you say, it is, your play is your work. And again, when I'm doing that, when I'm extending the love that I'm created from and I'm meant to be here to extend, I'm literally blessing the world with my interactions. And it's not me, the great and powerful Dr. Hayes, blessing anybody. It's the energy of life and love expressing through me. That's the blessing. And all I'm doing when I'm in that mode is I'm successfully keeping my garbage out of the way. I love that line from The Way of Mastery. Where it asks, you know, when somebody tries to ask you who you are, don't reply with all of these canned, trained, conditioned responses about I'm a Republican or I'm a male or I'm a father or I'm a psychologist or I live in Indiana or whatever. Don't talk about all of those external labels. Talk about the truth. Tell them, I'm the extension of love in form. I have never been born, and I will never taste death. I am infinite and eternal. I shine forth as a sunbeam to the sun. I am the effect of God's love, and I stand before you to love you. It'll raise some eyebrows if you say that to somebody. But it will also transform your life. So it's just one of the many lovely phrases that I'm glad I tuned into from The Way of Mastery, which to my ear, to my eye, to my sense is just a repetition of and a clarification of with a little bit more poetic simplicity the Course in Miracles teachings. It's all the same stuff. And our purpose in this show is not to talk about theory, is not to talk about philosophy. It's about to make practical tools available to people and support them in the application of those tools in their daily life. Because as the great teachers tell us, words don't teach. Experience teaches. And if I can get you out with me on a clear night like tonight, and I can point my finger up at this big, bright moon in the sky, all of my words about it, telling you all day today about how big it is, how beautiful it is, how bright it is, how it's going to be a clear night, they don't give you anything of the experience of going out and looking directly at the moon. They don't give you anything of the interior experience you can have if you're able to put away the stresses and the worries and the negative labels about yourself or your life and be there in clarity observing the moon. It's just a finger pointing at the moon. It's not the same thing as the moon. All of our talk on this radio show is just a finger pointing at the moon. What really can make a difference in your life is picking up these tools, filling out the worksheet, letting yourself do the targeted journaling that's alluded to in the Mind Shifter tool, letting yourself go back through your three earliest memories of conflict and mapping them out, and letting yourself understand how you created a template for your view of people, relationships, yourself, your life, the world around you, in your first three or four earliest memories of conflict that you've just been living out over and over and over again, that you've been using to color your perception ever since then. So we would love to support you in picking up the tools and using them. We're very grateful that you were here to share this time with us today. Come back again tomorrow and the next. And in the meantime, have the best year ahead of your eternal life. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.